Good morning. It's 9:06, and this is special election coverage on IPR News Radio. I'm David Castleman. And this hour, we have Libertarian Diane Basto in the studio. She's running for U.S. Congress in the 1st Congressional District. And we're going to chat about her ideas for reforming veterans' health care, about the war on drugs, about much more. And we're also going to talk a bit about the future of the Libertarian Party. And of course, we're going to take your questions and your comments for Diane a little later on in the show. Diane Basto, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thanks, David.
So how did you get involved in politics? How did this begin for you?
It was something I never anticipated and wondering a lot about as we get into the last 10 days or so. I went downstate to help Gary Johnson, really, as just a volunteer.
And that's the Libertarian presidential
candidate. Yes, and I went to the straw ballot, and then the Libertarian Party, to make a long story short, asked me if I would run.
So this was at the Libertarian convention in Michigan?
Yes.
When was this, and
where
was this?
In May, early May, in Lansing.
Mm-hmm. So somebody approached you. So you went to this convention not knowing that you were going to come out as a candidate for Congress.
Pretty much, yes. Uh-huh. Yes. Libertarians run a lot of people not necessarily thinking they're going to win, but to keep the message of what a libertarian is out there. So I said, yeah, but see, I don't know how to run to lose. So don't ask me if you don't mean to watch me try to win. And they said, okay, go girl. And so here I am.
Why did you say yes?
You know, this is going to sound really corny, but it's really duty. It's really duty. We knew by May how nasty and kind of empty this campaign was going to be at the national level. And I feel like I have a way of speaking and a manner and a sense of purpose and so forth that would make me actually really good at doing this job in Congress. So I felt that if I could, then I really should. I really should try to do some good in my time on Earth.
And you live in Gwin. That's
yes.
South of Marquette. Was
it is.
Like a half hour?
About a half hour, yeah.
In the Upper Peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
And but you weren't born there. Where did you grow up?
You don't have enough time for me to tell you all the places that I've lived, but the real answer that Michiganders want to know is, have I lived in Michigan? The answer is yes. Three different times. When I was in elementary school, I went to Greater Gratiot School on Gratiot Avenue. And then
in Detroit?
In northeast suburbs, yeah. And then later on, I went to Western.
Western Michigan.
Mm-hmm, graduated with a degree in psychology and one in English. And then I left to go away to graduate school in Florida and lived there for a long time. And then my husband and I, when he retired as vice president for student affairs at Virginia Tech, yet another turn in life, we went off in our motorhome around the country looking for where we wanted to retire. And I had been in the UP quite a bit. In fact, something nobody else can claim. I know nobody else can claim. I was actually there for the grand opening of the Mackinac Bridge.
Really?
Yes. And that gives me some cred somewhere. I don't know. We were on our way to the Porcupine Mountains because my uncle worked for Ford in Dearborn, and he loved the UP. The other thing is, when I lived downstate, the natural way to go to North Dakota, at least the one that made sense to me, was to come up through the state and across the UP. And my grandparents still lived in North Dakota at the time. So it's always felt home to me, no matter where I lived. And then my husband, who's from the South, just fell in love with it the first time we came through.
So what year did you move to Gwin?
About 3 years ago.
And you were you taught, correct?
I did.
English.
I taught English at Waterford Kettering. Yes, so
that's,
I did.
That's a high school in Southeast Michigan.
Yes.
What years were you a teacher there?
Uh, thanks. Well, let me just stipulate right now. I'm going to be 68 on Monday, okay? Halloween is my birthday. So if you start tracking the years, that's what it'll add up to. I was there in teaching school in 70 to 72, and then I went off to go to graduate school.
Mm-hmm. And you did some other things after you left teaching. I know that when we spoke earlier, you called yourself an entrepreneur. What were some of those businesses that you were involved with?
I started from scratch a yacht charter business. And what that really was is I had five sailboats in the charter fleet that people came in what they call bareboating.
This was in Florida.
This was in Florida, yes. And I've taught sailing. I have an ocean operator captain's license. I can carry people for hire. I can carry 49 passengers for hire. And I did that for really as long as I could afford before I lost too much money. But it was quite an experience. Another thing that I did that was really interesting was collect money for an expert witness who was owed money by trial attorneys. Now, trial attorneys argue for sport. So they're not saying they didn't owe the money. They're just saying they didn't want to pay it. So in a year, I collected $150,000, about $5,000 at a time from deadbeat trial attorneys. That will sharpen your teeth a little bit right there. But then the favorite thing I'd say of all was doing major remodels on houses. I like to do the design work. I like to do the general contracting. And on our house in Gwynn now, we added an addition to a little tiny house. And I actually did some of the work. I laid the PECs for the radiant heat, and I was just learning to hang doors when I decided to run for office, and that came to a halt.
And one of the things you told me about was your experience in the remodeling business when the housing crisis hit and the country spiraled into the Great Recession. What happened to you?
Well, we were in Blacksburg, Virginia, where my husband was at Virginia Tech at that time, and it was going well. I wasn't flipping houses. They were pretty major remodels with business partners and so forth. And the crash really started in 2006 in Blacksburg because a lot of the people that were moving to Blacksburg, which is in the mountains in Southwest Virginia, is gorgeous, were retiring people from D.C. And man, the crash started in 2006 in D.C. We got crashed really hard. We lost virtually everything except for pensions and Social Security. And we ended up, the only vehicle we had happened to be the motorhome that still had a lien on it. So nobody wanted to take the motorhome. We came very, very near bankruptcy. But we chose instead to live very frugally and pay everybody we owed, which we did over a four-year period. And now we've climbed back out, and we're not quite back to normal, but a lot, real close, getting a whole lot better, yes.
One of the interesting trivia bits about you is that you are Gary Johnson's first cousin. He's the Libertarian presidential nominee, of course.
Yes.
Have you spoken to him much during the campaign?
We text now and then. It's not anything about campaigns or any of that. It's just cousin stuff. Hey, Gary, wrote a great interview, that kind of thing.
So you're not trading bits of campaign tradecraft between
No,
you guys?
And I want to make it perfectly clear, they are not funding my campaign either. Let me make this perfectly clear. And even if that were policy with the campaign, you know, he wouldn't do that, because if I can't make this on my own, what good am I in Congress? So he's very about pulling your own weight.
How are you funding your campaign?
Begging small amounts, mortgaging things. Libertarians don't have a war chest. I don't have a war chest like my competitors do.
Can you give us an idea about what your big expenses are then as a candidate? I mean, I find it interesting just wondering what types of things you spend money on.
Well, the first thing I did to get name recognition was put out I bought 500 road signs, and I have put them out myself, 500 signs, plus some Gary Johnson signs beside them. That was, you know, $2,700 right there. The biggest thing is travel. I've put probably about 40,000 miles on the car now. The first district is 25,000 square miles. I mean, it goes all the way down to like Higgins Lake, you know, and all of the
UP. And all the way to Watersmead and almost to Wisconsin.
Well, Bessemer is the, or where I was last night, which is Iron Mountain. And I'll be in Detroit tonight. So that's about the length of the whole state. And I've crisscrossed it. I've come across the bridge probably about every 10 days since May for events here and then back and then. So the gas, we bought a little travel trailer that I use for lodging because I'm out often about 5 days at a time. It's too far to go back to Gwin, that's for sure. So it's that and eating out, you know, and that sort of thing. When I eat out, I meet people and I talk. So it's all campaigning, but those... It adds up pretty fast.
This is special election coverage from IPR News Radio. It's a live hour with Libertarian congressional candidate Diane Bostow. And we want to hear from you. Please call in. Are you a Libertarian? Are you thinking about voting Libertarian this year? Call in. We want to hear from you. The number is 800-681-5929. 800-681-5929. You referred earlier to some of the nastiness of this campaign season. Do you think that some of that has translated into more interest for libertarians, for, you know, in general, for third party candidates, or how do you judge that?
I think so. I know, especially in the UP, people say to me, oh, thank you for running. I'm so glad to have another choice. I can't stand it anymore. And certainly at the top of the ticket, I think it's going to make a great big difference. And whether I ride the coattails or actually I'm carrying Gary at this point, which is something I do point out, because Ubers don't watch so much television, so the television advertising doesn't really get to them very much. So my sign campaign, has actually been very effective. I wear a little plaque around my neck, and people say, oh, yeah, I've seen your signs all over the place. I say, yeah. Gary said it. He did give me advice when we started. I said, what do I do? I've never run for office. Help. And he said, first of all, it's name recognition. And I went, okay, all I know how to do is buy signs and put them out. I mean, that's about as cheap chic as I can get. And then he said, the other thing is, he said, just be nice. I went, well, okay, I'm going to try really hard on that one because sometimes I don't feel very nice, but it's true. It's true. People are so sick of the negativity that the fact that I will not even speak ill of my competitors, they like a lot, and they shake my hand and they thank me for that.
A lot of this, a lot of the talk in this campaign has played out over TV, you know, through TV ads. You know, it's really a lot of money's been spent by Democrats and Republicans, by the Lon Johnson campaign, by the Jack Bergman campaign to pay for TV ads.
Yes.
And those ads are about those two.
Yes.
Do you feel left out?
Right now, I'm really glad to keep my head down, let them shoot at each other. That's just fine with me. A couple of times in a forum setting, they've continued that, talking across my head, but I speak up and remind them that that's rude and I am actually sitting there, and it usually calms down a little bit. They're just so used to the two-party system that they can't. I don't even think they mean to be rude. I think it's just they're so used to the two-party system they can't even assimilate the fact that I'm there, but they get over that pretty fast because I'm pretty outspoken.
Not everybody knows probably exactly what libertarianism is. Mm-hmm. Not everybody knows, you know, exactly what libertarians stand for. You know, what does being a libertarian mean in a nutshell?
As a libertarian, I am very fiscally conservative. I am more fiscally conservative than Republicans, especially at this stage of the game. But I'm more socially accepting than the Democrats. As long as what you do doesn't bother me, it's not my business. And what I do shouldn't be your business either. So that's really the core of it. It's very respectful and stands on the Constitution. A brilliant document. It's amazing that people lived on Earth all at the same time to create that document. And very concerned that we're drifting rapidly away from the individual rights outlined in the Constitution.
And what are the main political positions that you're running on?
The first thing is to reduce the size of the federal government. I mean, drastically. I mean, really take some hits at it. The founders never meant for the federal government to be this bloated. They meant for it to be, well, the ones that thought there ought to be a federal government to start out with wanted it to be a very narrow kind of tight band of sort of umbrella for the states. And what we have now just bears no relationship to that. And therefore, we're out of touch with the money we're spending. And a $20 trillion debt and growing is not sustainable. It is the equivalent of a family that has an income of $22,000 a year spending $36,000 every year. And most people, when they put it that way, go, oh, yeah, well, that's not going to end well. What we're doing to sustain it is print money, and what that creates is inflation, and that hits the poorest people first. You know, if your grocery bill goes up by $10 a week and you still are on a fixed income, that's $10 less food you get.
This is special election coverage on IPR News Radio. It's a live hour with Libertarian congressional candidate Diane Bostow. Call in with your question. The number is 800-681-5929. We want to hear your comments, your questions. 800-681-5929. One of the parts of your platform that's on some of your campaign literature is that you want to end the war on drugs. And I'm wondering how exactly you think it should be ended. How should we end this war on drugs?
We should elect a president that would do it the first day. And since Richard Nixon did it by signature to start out, Gary Johnson would and could do it, undo it by presidential signature, too.
One of the longstanding positions is to legalize marijuana of libertarians. Should we legalize? I assume that you're for that.
Is
that?
I do. I don't use it. I never have used it. But well, on principle and on practicality, absolutely yes.
What about other drugs? What about heroin?
You know, I want to just take it one thing at a time. The real thing is the so-called war on drugs, which is really just a war on people. It's a war on addicts. It means we can't help people because we out them then, and then they can get arrested. The medical marijuana situation right now is a joke. My husband actually went ahead and got a card. He has a chronic back pain. He's taken too much Advil, and I think has quite a few years to live yet. So anyhow, he got his card, which is cumbersome and expensive. Isn't that interesting? The problem is that as long as it's illegal at the federal level, you can buy from a dispensary and still get arrested. The feds can, it's illegal. So we can talk all we want about medical marijuana, but as long as it's illegal at the federal level, we haven't gotten anywhere at all. And it's interesting, I guess probably because his wife is running for federal office, there is no marijuana in Michigan, to my knowledge. No one will talk to him about supplying it legally to him. And their right to be afraid. Their right to be afraid of the feds on this one, you bet.
And do you think that you said that this can be done at the federal or with the president's signature? One of the things that libertarians stand for is giving more rights to states. I mean, what if states, you know, want to keep the war on drugs going, like within their state? Should we, you know, do you support the federal government having a one size fits all policy on drugs, or, you know, should states?
I just want them out of it entirely. One of the interesting things, you know, it came up recently to declassify marijuana as a Schedule I narcotic, for heaven's right. sake, it's a plant. And I was reading about it, and it said the DEA decided that it would remain the current status. And I went, wait a minute. The Drug Enforcement Agency is setting policy? The enforcement, that's like the military being able to declare war. I mean, it's a bad idea to have that working that direction. It puts law enforcement in a position I doubt even they want to be in.
One of the things that people in northern Michigan are dealing with is the, you know, opioid crisis. You know, there's the number of people overdosing on opiates like heroin or some prescription drugs has skyrocketed.
Yes.
What's the libertarian answer to go after that?
Well, first of all, legalize marijuana and give people a choice. And most people would choose marijuana over a fistful of opioids. It's a big problem in the VA. The VA, you're not even allowed to grow a plant to research it. I mean, renowned research facility cannot grow a plant to do research on it. You're going to have to ask me a follow-up on that because that one makes me so mad. Ask me again.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think we should, you know, do to combat the opioid crisis in northern Michigan? I mean, is there a federal role in that, or is it kind of a state issue?
Well, it's a state issue. I mean, there are very, very few things that the feds ought to be into. It does mean on the state-by-state basis, some states aren't going to do very well at a lot of things. There are going to be some states that you wouldn't want to live in, you know. But that's true now, too. So the idea with going to the states, but it's not just the states, it's then counties and communities to get the decision-making down to an effective level where people really know the people that they're dealing with. So there are some places you just wouldn't want to live. But when the states start to notice, hey, you know, people don't want to come here because the schools are really bad, then they'll say, but, you know, gee, you know, Missouri's doing a really good job with that. So let's go see what they're doing. That's the concept.
Let's talk a bit about the federal debt, which you've referred to a couple times. And you've talked about reining in spending. What parts of the federal government should we rein in to cut spending?
Let me preface this by saying I'm not saying any of these, well, many of these things would be done in a day, but they're just federal agencies. Nobody even knows really what they do anymore. So, I'd like to go through line by line and just say, does anybody know what these people do? No? Well, then let's not have them anymore. Let's not have that agency anymore. This one sounds so hard to do, but it's really not. We really don't need to have an Internal Revenue Service. We can collect taxes. Some call it a consumption tax, fair tax, or whatever. We can collect taxes like we do state sales tax. It's pretty transparent.
So you support a national sales tax, in a sense.
In essence, yes. Yes, and the other thing about that is it gets that thing that we fill out every year, that where we have to tell pretty much what we spend on groceries, that's not the federal government's business to know all about that. They can collect taxes. We agree to that. But the IRS itself costs billions of dollars just to run it. And it's very invasive. And it can be used as a tool. People in office can go after a journalist, that kind of thing.
But, I mean, it is useful when you're spending trillions of dollars to have an agency that can collect trillions of dollars. So what areas, specifically, what agencies should we get rid of besides the IRS, I guess?
One of the things that actually a lot of educators support is no longer having a federal Department of Education. what happens is the feds collect, say, 15 cents. They send about 11 cents back to the state because they have to pay for themselves, you know, offices and chairs and that sort of thing. And then the huge kind of unsung part of that is cost of compliance. Everything we do, whether it's roads, federal roads, whatever, the cost of compliance is enormous. And with Common Core, when it really became obvious how much states and localities were spending in compliance with something they didn't really even like in the first place. So I'd rather have states and communities making those kinds of decisions and not have all that money go to the feds in the first place.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a couple minutes. You're listening to a live call-in show with Diane Bostow, a Libertarian candidate for U.S. Congress. You can join in the conversation by calling in. The number is 800-681-5929. That's 800-681-5929. We're going to be back in a couple minutes. This is IPR News Radio.
You're listening to special election coverage here on Interlochen Public Radio. We've got Diane Bostow with us here in the studio. She's the Libertarian candidate for the U.S. 1st Congressional race. If you'd like to ask her a question, give us a call after the break at 1-800-681-5929. I'm Morgan Springer, and in your weather forecast for Northwest Lower Michigan, today cloudy skies, highs in the upper 50s. Some rain in the overnight, also breezy, with lows in the mid-50s. Temperatures around 50 degrees both days this weekend. Patchy fog and cloudy on Saturday, partly sunny on Sunday. Warmer on Monday and Tuesday with partly sunny skies Monday, highs in the upper 50s. Mostly sunny on Tuesday, highs in the low 60s. You're listening to Interlochen Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in.
It's 9:33, and you're listening to special election coverage on IPR News Radio. All month, we've been talking with candidates for U.S. Congress in Northern Michigan. They're running for the 1st Congressional District, a massive district that stretches from the western Upper Peninsula down to Traverse City and across much of the northern third of Lower Michigan. I'm David Castleman. We have Diane Bostow in the studio right now. She's a Libertarian running for Congress. And we want to hear from you. Call in. Are you a Libertarian? Are you thinking about going Libertarian this year because you're maybe upset about the presidential candidates on the other sides? Call in. The number is 800-681-5929. That's 800-681-5929. Diane, I've heard you bring up veterans care a lot.
Mm-hmm.
At a forum we were at and before, and you've talked about reforming that system.
Mm-hmm.
What should be done to improve veterans care?
Well, the first thing I would do is let veterans choose what hospital they wanted to go to, like a voucher kind of thing. I don't know, you know, how to do it exactly, but whatever. Like you and I can go with insurance or whatever to any hospital. It would be interesting to see how many of them eventually chose a VA hospital. It would be nice for the VA hospitals to have to compete on timeliness, service, all that sort of thing. So I would start right there. I wouldn't close anything. I'd just make them another facility.
So are you for looking for a private model for veterans care? Or would you keep some of the centralized parts of the VA system?
I would start by keeping things kind of the way they are, but if the veterans and could choose, that would tell us a whole lot about what's wrong and what's right with the system. I'm sure there are right things too, but I think that's that making them have to be competitive with other facilities would kind of take the lid off a lot of things that aren't transparent right now.
What have you heard from veterans that you've spoken to while you've campaigned?
Well, one of the first things, the first guy, a guy in Marquette, he's just mad all the time about a lot of things. But the main thing is he said he's done 2 10-year hitches, and in each case, he took his oath and did his responsibility and came out, and people said, you know those benefits that you promised you? Well, not quite so much. Not quite so much. He's really mad about that, and I think a lot of veterans are mad about that, and they're mad about slow service and something that they need. A lot of them are mad because they are given a handful of opioids but can't smoke a little pot for their PTSD. And there's a lot of evidence that a lot of soldiers would be helped by just modest amounts of that. And the opioids, nobody has ever died. Look it up, call me, be mad, whatever. But nobody has ever died of an overdose of marijuana.
We're going to go to the phones right
okay.
now.
I'll bet we are.
We're going to go to the phones. And let me just remind you that you can call in with your own question or comment at 800-681-5929. That's 800-681-5929. We have John from Elk Rapids on the line. John, you're on the air. What's your question? John, can you hear us?
Hello?
Hi, John. What's your question?
Hi, yes. This is John Matthews. I'm a outgoing village council member in Elk Rapids, Michigan. And I wanted to commend you on stepping up and running for office. I really wish that a lot more of our citizens would do that.
Thank you.
But I had two questions or comments regarding policy issues. The first one is you made a statement that the Internal Revenue Service asked about my grocery bills in my itemized tax return. Now, I've been a business owner for a lot of years and worked with my accountant, and I've never had them ask me about my grocery bills. So that sort of rings a little bit false to me.
You want to respond to that, Diane?
It was a little hyperbole, probably. I apologize for that. It's the amount of the amount of asking of questions about how we spend our money that I object to. When we pay our sales tax, nobody asks us how much we made. They just ask, what did we buy? And then say, okay, well, then you pay X percent. A guy that has a $200,000 car pays tax on $200,000 car, $2,000 car, same rate, less amount.
Okay. I don't have any problem with the idea of a flat tax or a VAT in this country.
John, what's your second question?
Good direction to go in. The second question, and maybe perhaps this is a comment. I am, as far as Northern Express knows, and I've been able to tell, I'm the only black person ever elected to a public office in Northern Michigan. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about eliminating a federal Department of Education, to me that seems like going in the wrong direction, because in my opinion, so many of the issues that we have in this country today stem from a lack of education. And when you look at how education is controlled by the states, especially when you look into some of the states like Missouri, which had the issues with Ferguson, you'll see that there's so many places where we are not providing adequate education for our children. And to step back from the federal government even having any oversight over that, I believe, would be a mistake. Can you respond to that, please?
Well, certainly. I respect your view. I just don't think we get our money's worth back from them. the idea of state by state, I know, is a little, it takes a little getting used to, because the federal government in some things has created an umbrella that I think is helpful, but it's just so expensive. I just don't think we get our money's worth out of them. What we can do is demand more of our states. See, we wouldn't be sending that money to the federal government. We could collect it then at the state level, giving us more resources and you more access to the people that are making the decisions.
Let's go back to the phones. We have Lori and Benzie on the line. She has a question about people with special needs. Lori, you're on the air. What's your comment or question?
Thank you very much. I have a daughter with special needs. She's an adult, but she functions at a three-year-old level. That means that she needs to have someone full-time to care for her, which means that I can't work full-time, which means I don't qualify for things like health insurance through my employer. Were it not for Obamacare, I wouldn't have insurance and neither would she. My question is, recognizing the fiscally conservative nature of the Libertarian Party, how would you address individuals with special needs and their families who are unable to care for themselves?
It's interesting that you bring that up, because whenever I speak at a forum, and I like to call it the Affordable Care Act, because just to take the politics out of it, a lot of people have benefited greatly from the Affordable Care Act. So people say, well, we just need to end it right now. Now, what would we do for you, you know, if we ended it right now? The problem that I see that's really costing money with that, well, there are two things. One thing, the thing is like 20,000 pages. I mean, anytime a bill is that thick, you know that there's a lot of corruption, to just call it, in it. So the first thing I'd want to do is just tear the bill apart and get it down to, or the act, get it down to something you and I can understand. Then I really want to, it's the part of how healthcare is delivered, which is not transparent at all. If you try to find out, doctor gives you a set of tests, go have these tests, and you say, well, I'm not sure I can pay my copay about it. Let me see about it. And you call to find out what the test is going to cost, and you can't find out. I went through this myself. They will say, well, we can't tell you that. Excuse me. Well, because it depends on what insurance you have, and on and on and on and on. So I would spend, I would want to protect people in your position while we went over to the other side and tried to make healthcare far less expensive.
So Diane, okay. would you look toward getting rid of Obamacare in the long term, or to get up some of the structures that do make healthcare more affordable for low income people?
You know, I will have to tell you, until I read the 20,000 pages, and honestly, and okay, I'm glad we talked about that, because the thing I would do is get staff that are real whiz-bang at reading stuff like this, and we would actually go through it. People in Congress don't even read the bills. They're written by lobbyists, and they're made to be thick and not transparent. So the first thing I would do is get staff, and we would actually take, like, the Affordable Care Act and reduce it to something where I can't even talk about it because it is so non-transparent.
Mm-hmm. Should the government have a role? Go ahead, Lori.
I was just going to ask a quick follow-up question. To go beyond the question of the Affordable Care Act and whether or not it should be changed, or if it should exist at all, I'm curious as to what your perspective is on more on how we handle our special needs population, particularly adults with special needs, were it not for government intervention in the forms of Social Security and subsidies, and also even more funding NIH and programs that develop potential solutions to problems and diseases of people with special needs.
If you wouldn't mind, could I ask you if there is a thing what the most important issue to you is that you would like to see changed if I got to Congress and we were talking then?
I'm not sure that I want to see anything changed, actually, except I'm on the other side of the fence. I have a daughter with special needs. I would like to have some sort of I would like the country to spend more rather than less in addressing the problems of our special needs population.
Well, and that
obviously,
and that's a
it affects me personally.
Well, actually, my husband had a special needs child, so I know exactly. Well, I don't know what your life is like, but I certainly know the challenges of it, and I'm sympathetic to that. And as we went through revamping whatever it comes out to be at the other end, that is a keen issue in my mind, and that's the best I think I can say to you is I hear you, and I would want to continue to talk to you and get your suggestions.
You're listening to special election coverage on IPR News Radio. I'm David Castleman. This is a live conversation with Diane Bostow. She's a libertarian running for Congress in Northern Michigan. You can join us by calling in with a question. The number is 800-681-5929, 800-681-5929. You know, Lori brought up briefly Social Security benefits. She was referring to the ones that go to disabled people. What about the trust fund that pays out to retirees in this country? The Congressional Budget Office has said that you can debate the math, but that the trust fund is going to run out by 2029. That doesn't mean there's going to be no money, but it means that they'd have to reduce benefits if nothing else changed. How do you see how should the country reform Social Security, or should we get rid of it?
Well, those are questions that have to be. Yes, so my Social Security is going to run out before I'm dead. I am keenly aware of the problem. And of course, somebody your age is never going to see any at all, and yet you're paying into it. So the premises for Social Security in the first place really no longer exist because we're living so long and there are so many people my age.
But the premise, I mean, the basic premise is that older people are poor often. You know, they're often the ones at the margins of society. How would a libertarian, you know, respond to that central issue?
I think we would do a need based analysis on it. Not all seniors are poor. In fact, it's sometimes kind of ironic that we get senior discounts when the people that are really struggling are single parents with kids. Talk about somebody that needs a discount on something. So it's a little bit of a misnomer that we're all poorer. What we want is to open it up, first of all, for discussion. And with the gridlock in Congress right now, nobody's talking about it. Nobody is even talking about it. Smart, well-educated people need to sit down and say the very same questions. Do we even want Social Security anymore? Some people want us to leave that money in their pockets for them to invest themselves. You might want to do that.
Is that what you would want?
Maybe for myself, but I know not everybody has the background to invest for themselves. But there's nothing to keep groups of people to form together in an investment sort of setting to do it. I don't know the answer to it. I just know the questions, and I know that we're not talking about it. And if I get to Congress, I want to be that one libertarian in the middle of the room that says, okay, when you guys are through squabbling, can we sit down and talk about this? I'm really concerned about this next year in Congress because I don't know how people that have been this ugly to each other can even pretend that they're going to go make nice in Congress. It's not going to happen. And one thing about being the lone libertarian, I'm just one voice. But sometimes just one voice in the middle of the room saying, hey, over here, can we talk about this? Can make the difference. There are good people in Congress, but the two-party system is not letting them be good. And the vitriol is just going to be, what we've had in gridlock in the past, and my, well, it's kind of a joke, but it's not all that funny, it's going to be a food fight in January. I just can't imagine anybody getting along. My two opponents are just saying horrible things about each other on a daily basis, six times while I'm fixing dinner on my TV. And yet they say that when they go to Congress, they're going to make nice. I don't buy it. I don't think they're going to be nice at all. I promise. In fact, on my literature, I promise to be civil.
Just a few minutes left with Diane Bostow. You can call in with your question, with your comment, 800-681-5929. Just a few minutes left. The phone number is 800-681-5929. Still a lot to cover. We're not going to get to it all, of course, but a couple things.
Oh, you didn't have anything on after us. Can't we just run over? Your guy just fell off his chair. Apparently not.
One of the things we should definitely talk about is Line 5. That's the oil pipeline that goes across the Straits of Mackinac. It's a question asked at probably every single forum you've been to.
Yes.
Tell us what the libertarian answer, what your answer is to people's concerns about Line 5 across the Straits of Mackinac, the oil pipeline.
Well, ironically, I'm on Lon Johnson's mailing list, whether he knows it or not. I don't think he does. Because I sent $25 because he was expressing concern over it, and I wanted to learn more about it. That was when I was not running. When I started running, I said, okay, now I really have to learn for myself. I have to go do independent research, talk to people on various sides of the issue, and I did. And my conclusion is this, that of infrastructure problems that we have, roads, bridges, dams, all sorts of things in Michigan, this one is probably the best managed and near the bottom of the list of big concerns. Does it need monitoring? Of course it does. Of course it does. Everything does. And but I think it is not the crumbling mass of clay like your sewer going to the street. It is a stout steel glazed. I mean, it was built at the same time as the Hoover Dam, and nobody's talking about taking the Hoover Dam down, and nobody's talking about the bridge. And I can tell you about how old that is since I was there for the opening. I think that is a red herring. I just think that it was
something. You think it's an overblown issue?
Yes, I do. And if people would take the time, do their homework, keep an open mind, read on all sides. Native people disagree. People have lots of opinions. But in terms of the engineering, I don't think that there's that much question. Whether it should be, not be, it is. And the worst thing that could happen is to be shut down and abandoned and have no one responsible for it at all.
You think that's worse than an oil spill?
It's worse. Would you say that again? The two parts of that sentence didn't make any sense.
You said that was the worst thing that could happen would be abandoning it. And I'm wondering if
you think
that's
to the pipeline. See, right now, in current use, it's being maintained. Somebody's making a buck on it, and they're making sure that it works. If that were just shut down, who would be responsible for it? And then with no maintenance on it, if you just walked away, closed it and walked away from it, now you're looking for trouble. Something not maintained like that would be a problem. I don't see it as a problem.
Well, if they weren't running oil through it, though, what would be the problem?
Just general, like maintenance on a house. I mean, it just will age without being kept up. You don't paint your house, it peels, it's gone. Whereas if you, keep at it on a yearly basis, then it doesn't crumble and go away. We have a lot of abandoned mines, particularly in the UP, that no one is responsible for. Now that's trouble. And that's a problem that's not quite so sexy to talk about, but it's a really big problem. Seepage into Lake Superior is a big problem.
Unfortunately, we got to move on to one more topic I definitely want to get to. A couple foreign policy questions. One of the things that you've said is that you want to maintain a strong national defense. while staying out of foreign entanglements. Can you explain that a bit more, knowing we just have a few minutes left?
The Constitution talks about maintaining a military for the defense of the country. It doesn't say for aggression. And that's the way I feel about it. An extremely strong defense, but that we don't go trying to decide in other countries how they should run it and how they should live. I think we've really found out with a lot of loss of life, particularly in the Middle East, that in spite of brilliant efforts on the part of our military to share technology and knowledge and so forth, the minute we walk away, things go back to where they were. And that's what happens. And I don't think we ought to spend American lives on that.
One of the big questions is what to do about Syria, where there is, there is a humanitarian crisis. Hundreds of thousands of people have died. Should the U.S. have any role there going forward in the future?
We're not going to make it better. So, no, I heard somebody make the analogy the other day. If your neighbor's house was on fire across the street, would you send your children to put it out? It needs to be that these are it's easy for you and me sitting here to send soldiers there. Perhaps if we knew we could make it better, it'd be a different thing. But typically, things are at least as bad or worse when we leave.
You're going to introduce later today Gary Johnson in Detroit. It's a rally,
yes,
in Detroit?
At Cobo Hall.
Mm-hmm. And that's this evening?
It is. When I walk out the door, I'm driving to Detroit.
What are you going to say? Can we get a preview?
Oh, I'm going to tell things like, you know, just family kind of stuff, not so much politician stuff, because that's really what they're going to want to hear. Gary made me a better skier simply by being on the hill. I don't know how he does that, but he just makes everybody want to do better. I'm going to say that he really likes to cook. Who knew? that he is... He expects us all to pull our own weight, and by golly, you just find that you do. He is totally non-judgmental, and he is as straightforward in interaction with me as he is in interacting in the campaign. The guy you see is the guy who is.
Our time, unfortunately, is just about up. One last question before we go. When you're on the campaign trail and you've got, 30 seconds to make a pitch to voters, what do you say? What's your pitch for why voters should select you on November 8th?
The fact that I'm fiscally conservative and care about a balanced budget because of the long-term problems of just letting this carry on like this, and that I'm socially accepting, that I want people to have control of their own lives. I'm concerned about interference by government and parts of people's lives that are just, it's not the government's job and they don't really have the right. And we've asked for too much governance, I think, at the expense of the individual.
Diane Bostow, thanks for coming on.
Thanks, David.
And this has been special election coverage on IPR News Radio. Thanks to Diane Bostow for coming in this morning. Morgan Springer helped produce the show. She ran the phones. Peter Payette was our engineer this hour and executive producer. I'm David Castleman, and you are listening to IPR News Radio, WICA, Traverse City, 91.5 FM, WLMN, Manistee, Ludington, 89.7 FM, WHBP, Harbor Springs, Petoskey, 90.1 FM. We're online over at over at IPRnews.org, and you can find many, many more stories from our election coverage from the 1st Congressional District. Just click Running for First. Have a nice weekend, everybody. The Diane Rehm Show is next. It's just before 10 o'clock.